No problem. So, thank you very much for coming to the course. I don't know if everyone is able to make it for all 4 weeks, but I hope you are able to. At the end, I'll probably pass around the page for sign-ins and email addresses so that I could actually send you the link and also send you sheets in advance for the classes. Not that you're required to look at the sheets in advance, but this way, you know, you have it at any rate. The topic for week one is wars of Jewish publishers, as you can see at the top of the sheets. Sorry, we only have 8 sheets. We had 2 people signed up, and we ended up with what looks like significantly more here in the room. Sharoni, being optimistic, made 8 copies, but that's still not enough. So that's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to go back to the beginning of printing press publishing. So we're talking about 15th century, 16th century Europe. And specifically, the place where today's class takes place is actually Venice. Remember that Italy of that time is divided up into subunits. It isn't a country called Italy. We're going to be talking about what happens in the Republic of Venice, which is in central Italy. Italy was the leading area in Europe in terms of early adoption of the printing press, even though most of the successful Italian printers in the early going were actually German, not Italian. Italy, that area, those republics, tended to be the place where it took off, quite possibly connected to the role of the church. Remember that the church had a vested interest in, number one, Bible, and in printing, and also in controlling printing. Because the concern is, someone can suddenly mass-produce literature. What happens if that literature is heretical? And so the church steps in, not only to make use of printing for its purposes, but also to control printing. And in the Republic of Venice, printing was controlled by the Venetian Senate. Remember that Venice was controlled in its earliest days by a monarch-type ruler called the Doge, D-O-G-E. That begins somewhere around the year 700. About 400, 450 years later, they developed something called the Great Council or the Major Council. I would use the Italian term for it if I could pronounce it properly, but I can't. But they developed this council as a democratic counterweight to the Doge. The result being that the Doge becomes more of a figurehead, actually, and the council ends up running the country. Then in the year 1229, they form something called the Senate, which is an aristocratic government elected by the major council. The major council has hundreds of people. It's entirely unwieldy. This group, this aristocratic group called the Senate, is elected by the major council, and they tend to carry out the major work. And those are the ones who control the trades. So if you want to enter a trade, you want some kind of license, you have to go to this group, the Senate, and certainly if you want a monopoly. Because beginning in the 14th century, they actually granted monopoly rights to people who had special skills and techniques. So if you were a particularly good artisan in some form of craft, then you could petition the Senate and get the rights to be the only one who could engage in that trade in the way that you're doing it. It's a patent office, essentially, an early version of a patent office. So in 1469, the Venetian Senate becomes the first European government to grant a monopoly to a printer. And from there on, 1469. And from there on, their control over printing is pretty much consolidated for a long time afterwards. It's under their control. That's important to know for the story as it's going to develop. I'm sorry I don't have more sheets to give you. That's what we have. If you give me your email address at the end, then I'll be able to email you the sheets. Okay. Jewish printing in that era. 15th century, 16th century Italy. Hebrew presses were actually among the earliest in Italy. The first Hebrew book printed in Italy with a publishing date that we can actually identify was produced in 1475. So we also were early adopters for the same reason that the church was. Because, again, we could make use of it. We didn't have the control they had. The church had the control because they were the ones in authority in Venice. That's not a position that we held. But we did make use of it at any rate to promote our own teachings. Most 15th century Hebrew printers were Jews, led by a family you may have heard of, the Sansino family. They published not only Bible, they published works of Jewish law, Jewish liturgy. They also published non-Hebrew books for that matter. By 1500, about 200 Hebrew books, Hebrew texts, had been printed in Venice. The readers were not only Jews. They were also Christians who were versed in Hebrew and would read. Christian Hebraists were strong at that point. However, Jews ended up being run out of the Hebrew printing business because there were prohibitions against Jews engaging in printing and selling books to people who are not Jewish. So now selling your books to the Christian Hebraist, that actually became a dangerous thing to do. And Jews are run out of the industry, and instead, the industry becomes dominated by Christian printers. Well, how are they going to have the expertise in the Jewish text? No problem. They hire Jews, or Jews who had converted to Christianity, as their proofreaders, as their editors, as the composers of the type, and Jews end up working for the non-Jewish printers. The most prominent of these printers, his name actually sounds very Jewish, is Daniel Bamberg.
Yeah.
Is anyone here familiar with the Mikraot Gedolot edition of the Bible, of the Chumash? Mikraot Gedolot, for a very, very long time, centuries we're talking about, has been the standard Hebrew text used by students of the Bible because it was text. And then around the text, you had some of the classic commentaries. Rashi's commentary is on the page there. Ramban, Nachmanides is on the page there. And several others. And it really became the one-stop shopping type of edition. That's what you would use. Well, it was first printed by this fellow Daniel Bamberg, who sounds like a nice Jewish boy, but in fact was not. He was actually from Antwerp. He was not Jewish. And his high-quality craftsmanship and his excellent arrangement of the type gave him dominance of the field. In 1550... Yes?
If all those businesses, those Jewish-owned printing businesses, were expropriated, but we know the Sansino name today, what happened to them?
The name may remain. Sometimes the houses would retain a name because everybody knew it, and it just gained new ownership. You find these family names continue on for generations there in Italy, and even when the original family isn't in control anymore. When I lived before coming here, I used to get a haircut at Woody's Barbershop. Woody had retired long since, but it was Woody's Barbershop. That's the way it went.
Did the type fonts that Bamberg used come from Sochino, or did he start it again from scratch?
Right, so that's actually a great question, which leads into a whole other discussion about how they developed their fonts. But it's likely they were new. It's likely they were new for two reasons. Number one, generally speaking, you had in-house scribes, and the in-house scribes actually created the fonts that you used, which leads to some very interesting variations in Hebrew fonts in that day. But second, because you had issues that came up about not reusing type that had been created for a different work. It was almost a copyright issue. In other words, I paid for that type. You can't now use that type to print something else. You're making money off of what I paid for. It's really my type now. And that's its own discussion, which we will not get to today. Well, in 1515, the Venetian Senate grants Bamberg an exclusive privilege to print Hebrew books. There was tremendous dissatisfaction with this whole practice, though, of granting printing privileges, which had begun, as I said before, back in 1469. Because when you grant someone a monopoly, what happens? The price goes up and the quality goes down, right? That's what happens with monopolies. Not to mention it drives out the competition, and then you have nothing. There isn't even a possibility of competition. So in 1517, just 2 years into his 10-year monopoly, the Senate revokes all existing printing privileges, including Bamberg's. Bamberg, nonetheless, manages to convince, probably translate that word as bribe, the Senate to renew his printing monopoly. That's the way it worked. To renew his printing monopoly for another 8 years. And then again, it comes up in 1526, and he gets it for another decade. At that point, we have on record that he paid the sum of 500 ducats to purchase this privilege. And he is the printer. He's the one. You want anything done in Venice in terms of Hebrew printing, you go to Bamberg. 1545, a man by the name of Marc Antonio Giustiniani, which is a great name by the way, establishes a Hebrew press in Venice. There's another Marc Antonio Giustiniani who lives about a century later, who was the Doge in Venice. That's not him. But Marc Antonio Giustiniani establishes a Hebrew press in 1545 in Venice. He does come from a patrician family, and he is a cutthroat rival to Bamberg, who was already, frankly, reaching the twilight of his career. Mm-hmm. So Giustiniani takes out public ads, wanting to everybody to know he's going to come out with beautiful editions. He hires away some of Bamberg's key editors. He hires away people who compose the type. And his style is different from that of Bamberg. Bamberg really emphasized high-quality printing. Mm-hmm. Giustiniani tends to add little things to the text, indexes, which can be very useful, illuminations in the sides of the manuscripts, translations sometimes. But the quality of the work isn't great. And in Hebrew works, what that often means is that you can actually be reading a sentence and suddenly there's a word missing, or there's type that's smudged, and you just have to live with it. You just deal with it. That's what you're working with. Well, Giustiniani sets about putting Bamberg out of business. So that when Bamberg prints a reprint of a text, so he has no copyright, he has no license, the government in Venice, the Senate, would grant copyright when you printed an original work, but not if you were just reprinting something that everybody had access to. So Giustiniani would immediately print the same text. So in 1545, Bamberg publishes the classic work of Midrash, commentary on biblical text called Medrash Rabbah, and Giustiniani does the same in an edition that's almost identical, but he puts it out cheaper. In 1546, Bamberg publishes a grammar work by Rabbi David Kimchi called Sefer HaSharashim. 1547, Giustiniani comes out with two editions, one with a Latin translation. Bamberg sometimes prints original texts that he gets licensed by the Senate, so then Giustiniani can't do anything about that. So what he does instead is he comes out with other works of the same genre and tries to make those the work that anybody studying the genre is going to get. So there's a work called Sefer Mitzvot Gadol by Rabbi Moshe of Kutzi of France. It's a collection of the mitzvot in the Torah, an explanation of each commandment. And in 1546, 1547, Bamberg publishes that. So at the same time, Giustiniani publishes a similar work called the Kolbo. In 1546, Bamberg publishes a work on prayer and custom called Shibboleth Halakhot. And so Giustiniani comes out with a work called Sefer Abu Dirham as some have it, the same year. It's the same type of a work. It's also about liturgy and custom. In 1546, Bamberg publishes a work called She'iltot, which is a work of law that goes back to the times of the Gaonim. You're talking about 9th century. He manages to get a good manuscript together, and Bamberg puts it out, so Giustiniani publishes a legal work also from the Gaonic period in 1548. Yes.
When they're fighting like this, what size are these production runs? I want to get a sense of it.
Right. So from what I know, I don't have information on all of these, but in general, you're talking about a couple of hundred. That's basically the range. So the competition ultimately puts Bamberg's press out of business. 1548, 1549, Bamberg is out. And for a short time, Giustiniani has a de facto monopoly. Not de jure, he isn't licensed as a monopoly, but realistically there's no one out who can compete with Giustiniani. Enter Alvis Bragadin. The house of Alvis Bragadin comes out, and it's in the early 1550s, with an edition of Maimonides' magnum opus. Now, it's dangerous to say Maimonides' magnum opus. It's not a tongue twister, but it's dangerous to say that because Maimonides had many works he could classify as a magnum opus. When he's all of 17? I think he's 17. It's either he's 17 or he's 30, but I think it's when he's 7. Well, let me say 30 in case I'm wrong. He publishes a commentary to the entire Mishnah, which is the foundation of the Talmud, put out, originally published, not published, but originally written down and canonized in the 3rd century of the Common Era. This is the foundation for Judaism's entire approach to analyzing, interpreting, extrapolating from biblical text. It's a monumental work. It's 63 volumes. And Maimonides comes out with a commentary on the entire thing. So some people call that his magnum opus. On the other hand, he also writes a work of philosophy called, in English, Guide of the Perplexed, in Hebrew, Moreh HaNevuchim, and that some consider his magnum opus. On the other hand, there is something that he wrote called the Mishneh Torah, which is his work of law, in which he revolutionized the way that Jewish law is studied. And I can't say that strongly enough. Absolutely revolutionized it. And this is what I mean. The Mishnah, I explained, was 3rd century is when it's canonized. The same group of sages who work on the Mishnah start developing a greater work that's the expansion of the Mishnah. It's often called Gemara. Classically, it was called Talmud. The way it went from Talmud to Gemara is actually that the censors, who we'll talk about in a later class, the Christian censors banned works that contained the word Talmud. So they decided, you know what, we're going to use the word Gemara instead. The Gemara is just an Aramaic version of the same word. Gimel Mem Resh, as an Aramaic root, means to learn. So it's the same thing as Talmud, which is also a book of learning. But they weren't banning Aramaic at that point. But we'll discuss that at another time. In any case, this Gemara is canonized actually in two forms. One form in what's then known as Palestine, another form a little bit later in Babylon. The Babylonian Talmud is canonized in the middle of the 6th century Common Era. At that point, if I want to know Jewish law, I have to read the discussions in the Talmud and try to figure out who wins, which is not always easy. Okay, sometimes you read it and the answer is, I don't know. And so now, well, what do I do? I have debates. And so you have to sit down and really work it out, and it requires real serious knowledge. And that's the way that people learn law until you get to basically the 9th century. 9th century, maybe into the early 10th century. If I have a question I can't resolve from the Talmudic text, I write a letter to the Gaon. The Gaonim, that's the plural of Gaon, were the heads of the major schools basically centered in Iraq and northern Africa in those days. About the 10th century, there's a shift. And what you find instead is that sages actually go through the Talmud and try to collect legal passages, passages that are specifically about law and provide conclusions, and bring them into separate books. So one does it in this work called the Baal Halachot Gedolot. Another one does it in that She'ilto that I mentioned before. And then Rabbi Yitzchak, living in Fez in Morocco, does it with his own work, which is called the RIF, which is just an acronym, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi. And those are fine, but still very hard to use when you think about it, because I'm still reading discussions and having to extrapolate. Along comes Maimonides. End of the 12th century, beginning of the 13th century. Well, no, end of the 12th century. He comes along and he says, this is silly. This is not the way to do things. And he goes through all of these works and he composes instead what he calls his Mishnah Torah, his summary of Torah. And the way he does it is he organizes law by topic. So he says, for example, here's a work called Laws of Shabbat. Here's a work that's the laws of Yom Kippur. Here's a work that's laws of temple sacrifice. Here's a work that's laws of financial litigation in court. Here's laws about how we deal with murder. Here's laws about. It's 14 different volumes, each one consisting of several sub-volumes. An incredible, incredible work, which formed really the foundation for how Jewish law was studied for the next 400 years. Until it was actually superseded by another work called the Tour, which we're going to come back to later. Yes?
What did he do when he was 17?
What he did, and not only that, you have to read his medical writings. His medical writings are incredible. His medical writings are absolutely incredible. And we could do a four-week series on Maimonides and not even scratch the surface. Going back to the... seriously, if we didn't know he had existed, if we didn't have his own hand writing this, I would have said he was a myth. But he's not. He's one person, and it's absolutely incredible. So, Alvis Bragadin publishes a new edition of this Mishnah Torah, this work of law, using the scholarship as well as financial investment of a man by the name of Rabbi Meir of Padua. Rabbi Meir of Padua, his full name was Meir ben Isaac Katzenellenbogen, which is a good name. He was born in Katzenellenbogen in Germany, so hence the...
There's a lot of people who claim descent from him.
That doesn't surprise me.
I'm one of them.
No kidding. How do you like that? Did you know we were going to discuss him today?
No.
Huh. Surprise. So he was a leading rabbinical authority in his day. He was born in 1473. He passed away in 1565. He initially studied in Prague, and then he moved to Padua, which is in Venice. He was the head rabbi in the ghetto there in Venice. Venice was a seat of both secular and Jewish learning at the time. It attracted quite a few intellectuals. Yes, he became the chief rabbi of Padua in 1525. I just have to read my own notes. He was head of the court there, the Beit Din, the Jewish court in Venice. He was head of the Venetian Regional Council of Rabbis, head of the yeshiva, the academy in Padua as well, all until his death in 1565. So he puts together a commentary on Maimonides' Mishneh Torah, this work of law. He has a number of corrections of earlier editions in terms of the text of Maimonides as well as text of the medieval commentators who are there. He also annotates the text. See, Maimonides did one thing which got himself into a lot of trouble with this Mishneh Torah of his. He wrote a preface in which he said, you know, all you need to learn is this Mishneh Torah. That angered a lot of people because no one likes a braggart. I mean, he wasn't a braggart. That wasn't what he was doing. He's not boasting. He's trying to say, this is really what you need. Just learn this and you'll be in good shape. But it certainly comes out sounding like boasting. You don't need to learn the Talmud anymore. Just learn my Mishneh Torah. It did get him into quite a bit of trouble. His works actually ended up being burned at one point, and this was one of the major reasons. And there were other reasons. But in any case, so along comes this Rabbi Meir of Padua, and he annotates the text with references to Talmudic sources. So if I want to know, where did Maimonides get this from? Now I can read the text and say, oh, there it is. It's from such and such a site. It's actually very useful information. He also added a little commentary of his own. He incorporated commentaries that had appeared in earlier editions of Mishneh Torah. He incorporates some additional material. Maimonides, one of Maimonides' other works, was a listing of the 613 mitzvot. Classically, the Talmud mentions that there are 613 commandments. Deduced from a verse, that's not critical to what we're doing right now. But in the medieval period, there was a rivalry almost between scholars to try to figure out how you ended up with 613. Because you could easily count them a couple of thousands. And the question is, what counts and what doesn't count? What's included and what isn't included? For example, I have a commandment of acting with chesed, with kindness toward other people. Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of ways you can be kind. Right? So Talmudically, we're taught visit people who are ill, bury the dead, give tzedakah, right? We have all these different subcategories. So is each its own mitzvah? Or is it a mitzvah of be kind to other people? Right? Questions like that, which to a certain extent sound like angels on a head of a pin. Does it really matter whether I count them as 5 or 15 or 50? But there are legal ramifications for the way that I count these. So Maimonides wrote a work called Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of the Mitzvot, and that was included in this as well, along with Nachmanides' comments on why Maimonides is wrong in his Sefer HaMitzvot. Rabbi Meir of Padua had first approached Justiniani, the reigning printer of the day, and said, will you print this? And they couldn't come to terms. Because the way it worked was, if you were a Jew trying to get your scholarly work published, you had to put up the money. The printer wasn't putting up the money for this. So they couldn't come to terms, and that was when he went to Bragadin and said, Bragadin, you want to get into Jewish printing? And hence the battle is joined. So Bragadin publishes it. Lo and behold, shortly thereafter, Justiniani comes out with an edition of Mishneh Torah, of this work, along with the source references that Rabbi Meir Katzenelnbogen has put into the text, along with Rabbi Meir of Padua's commentary. It's all there in a work published by Justiniani. That's a problem. He's looking at all of his investment, right, disappearing. And it's nice to have your scholarship, you know, spread, but what is he going to do now? Not only that, but Justiniani apparently had an element of sour grapes that Raimero Padua had not decided to publish with him. Or maybe he's trying to warn off future people who would similarly spurn him. And so he moves the commentary by Raimero of Padua to an appendix. And in his preface to the volume and to the appendix, he criticizes the commentary as worthless. He says, this was written for nothing. He says, scholars from Yemen to the West have told me that this commentary really should be removed from the text, that his annotations are wrong or sought to explain things that are understood even by a person who's a day old. Please don't be insulted. I think this is just, you know, trash talk. It's industry trash talk. That's all it is. He says, I'm only putting it in here in order to enable scholars to judge their worth independently. That's what he writes. He even says that leading scholars had approached him, pleading with him to rush out an alternative to this Rabbi of Padua's shoddy edition. That's my real motivation. I want to serve the community. And he says, these scholars have given me added value for my edition. And by the way, I'm publishing it at a significantly lower price. Because I want you to be able to get books cheaply. You know, it's from the good. It's a goodwill thing, right? So you now have a major problem. Well, right, Mayor of Padua does not take this sitting down. Instead, he looks for what we call in Hebrew a psak, a legal ruling. He wants an outside adjudicator to say, this is wrong, no one should buy this work. Now, the state of secular copyright law today is founded on the Statute of Anne from 1709, which, of course, is after this. You had the idea of protected copyright in those days, but you didn't really have the same legal structure that we're familiar with today. Today, we have four different schools of thought that govern copyright law. One view, which William Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England has, is that an author owns the right to the fruits of his labor. If I produce something, it's mine. Just like if I take metal out of the ground and shape it into a tool, it's mine. If I take words and put them in a certain order, they belong to me. Those words are now mine. And you don't have the right, even if you use your own materials, your own ink, and your own paper, you can't copy down the information that I've composed. That's one school of thought.
What was that?
Blackstone's Commentaries? I don't know, actually. Good question.
Did the word plagiarism?
Plagiarism as a concept is not really the same thing, right? Plagiarism would be if I took someone's work and claimed it as my own. Oh. Copyright protects me even if I say so-and-so wrote it. So I don't think that's the same. I expect I'll be able to look up the year on Blackstone, and I'll get back to you if you give me your email address at the end.
I will. I expect the move from you.
But it's good information to have. A second approach is that government actually is the reason for copyright. Government wants to encourage the advancement of learning, and therefore they will protect people who generate works of learning. Even though technically the author doesn't have the right, it's in the government's best interest. That's the second approach. Another approach is that copyright is simply trade regulation. Just like government regulates communications, fair competition in general, so too government regulates this. It's just an industry standard, and the government can create whatever standard it wants to govern the way this works. Fourth approach is an interesting one. This is great. Copyright is not economic at all. Rather, that which you create is an extension of your body. In other words, I don't know if my children will accept this idea, but the idea is that my work is just like my arm. It's not an economic thing. It's part of me. And therefore, for you to take that and replicate it and do what you want with it is just as illegal as assault and battery. That's a fourth school. Well, Jewish law of that period does not seem to recognize the existence of a separate intellectual property. It's not there. If you take a look on your sheets, and here we get to these odd sources that I included. This is from the Code of Jewish Law. The Code of Jewish Law had just appeared about 20 years before this dispute occurred. But it's codifying what exists already in earlier works of law. And the Code of Jewish Law, known in Hebrew as the Shulchan Aruch, rules, one may transfer through sale or gift only items of substance. Intangible items may not be transferred. There's no such thing as selling something intangible. And the reason for that is that there's no such thing as owning it. I don't own something that's intangible. If I compose a song and you hear the song and you want to replay the song on your own instrument, go ahead. There's no protection, classically, for this. So based on that, it sounds like Rabbi Meir Katzenelenbogen is out of luck. Not necessarily, though. Because the case comes to a man by the name of Rabbi Moshe Isserles of Krakow. Rabbi Moshe Isserles is all 20 years old. He has just been appointed the chief rabbi of Krakow, which is a very large community in those days. He is well on his way to becoming the leading Ashkenazi authority in Jewish law, which will be cemented shortly thereafter, because this Shulchan Aruch, this Code of Jewish Law that had just come out, he would end up writing the definitive work on it from the Ashkenazi perspective. The Code of Jewish Law was written by Rabbi Yosef Karo, whose name we're going to come back to a little bit later. He was from Turkey, then he moved to Israel, he lived in Sfat, and he wrote this Code of Jewish Law from the perspective of Sephardic Jews. But Sephardim and Ashkenazim had been sort of developing apart for about 300 years before, a little more even, before this happened. And so Rabbi Moshe Isserles writes a commentary on it, saying, well, in these cases, we actually disagree. Now, Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, is a very large work of law. And he writes this work, and it becomes very popular, really instantly. So that tells you about the scholarship of Rabbi Moshe Isserles of Krakow, and why you would go that far afield, right? You're going from Italy to Poland to get a ruling. But there are other reasons why he goes to him. Yes?
And what year is this?
This is, I think, 1552, but I'm not 100% sure. It's in that range, though. It's for sure early 1550s.
How many people in Krakow?
I don't know the number. I have to say, I don't know the number. I can say I'm going to look that up, but I don't actually know that I'm going to find anything. It is, at that point, though, a very important Jewish community, because as Jews flee from the Inquisition, some of them head south. Some of them go to Turkey, right? That's one safe haven, and other points in general within the Muslim world, actually. And then some of them head east and end up in Poland. So it's a significant and growing community at that stage.
Even 3,000 would be a large community at that time.
Could be, but I think this is actually significantly larger than that. Yeah. So there are other reasons, though, why Rabbi Moshe Istel is a particularly appealing justice for this case. Rabbi Meir of Padua was known as a proponent of the rationalism that Maimonides promoted, and so was Rabbi Moshe Istel. They're both promoters of the study of science. They both support codification of Jewish law, which was still a major controversy at that point as to whether we should have legal codes or whether those who want to study law should go back to the Talmud and actually read their way through it. So they're very close in that sense. They also happen to be second cousins once removed, which is another reason to go to him, right? So, which makes you also then a relative of Rabbi Moshe Istel.
I'll go with it.
Okay.
What's this thing about sciences?
The study of secular science and rationalism, the supporting rationalism in general, which, you know, in 16th century Italy is a very interesting debate. It's certainly not resolved that rationalism is the way to go on a variety of issues. Okay. So what does Rabbi Istel do? Well, he rules in favor of Rabbi Meir of Padua. That's where he ends up. He only gives him an exclusive right, though, to sell out his already printed edition. That's what he says. That you can do. And the idea is that you can prevent competitors from undermining your chance to recover your investment. That's legitimate. However, you have no enduring proprietary right in this product of your intellectual labor, expertise, creativity. Because, again, you look at the core law, and at that stage, there is no recognition of an intellectual property right. The government, the secular government, doesn't provide one either. We do have a principle of dina de malchuta dina, that the law of the land is the law. But the law of the land didn't prohibit Justiniani from doing what he did. There's nothing there. So what exactly is the basis for Rabbi Isserlis' ruling? Well, first of all, he said, in general, the people who are not Jewish, if they come to us for judgment, are subject to our laws. So if Justiniani comes to me and says, what's the ruling? I'm going to give him the ruling. Realistically, that's not the case. So his ruling is really for the Jews. But in any case, frankly, I would say most of the copies of this Mishnah Torah were being sold to Jews. So that's okay. The random Venetians could choose to listen or not. He presents four reasons, though, for ruling in favor of Rabbi Meir of Padua, and it's fascinating to hear his logic. His first argument is unfair competition. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 2, that's just his introduction, actually, to his responsum when he says, I'm going to get involved here. We will not abandon our part. We declare that all Israel and anyone known as Israel should not purchase any new copy of Maimonides other than those which emerged from the hand of the aforementioned Gaon. He uses Gaon loosely there to mean scholar. Or those whom he has empowered for the following four reasons, which we're now going to see. If you take a look at source number 3, it's a passage from the Talmud dealing with unfair competition. And it talks about an alleyway. What we mean when we say alleyway is not quite what you may be thinking of, so let me explain that a little bit more. Medieval streets, medieval urban design, okay, for Jews living in Babylon, you had a major thoroughfare in a town, okay? That's your big road. Often called Reshut HaRabim, sometimes called Derech HaRabim. Off of that, you would have side streets, called a Mavui in Aramaic. And that's actually what they were referring to here as an alley. Off of those alleys, you tended not to have houses immediately. What you had was called a Chatzer. You would have a yard. And the yards would open off of those alleys, so to speak. And then houses would open off of the yards. So the idea is, if I want to get home, I take the major road, I'm coming in from the fields, or from the marketplace, whatever it is, I come in on the major road, I turn onto the alley, and off of the alley I get to my yard, where my house is. It's a very good idea to open your business on the alley, right? As long as there are enough houses that open off of enough yards that come off of this alley, everybody walks past there. That's where you want your business. Until the city decides to do construction, then all bets are off. But but that's what we're talking about here. Rav Huna said, if an alley resident establishes a mill, okay? So he doesn't live in the alley. He lives off of that. But he sets up a mill in the alley. And another alley resident establishes one before him. Before him means closer to the main road. The former is legally able to prevent this, saying, you are interrupting my livelihood. Kapaskis lechevasoi is the phrase in Aramaic. You are interrupting my livelihood. I was here. You can't just take away all my business by getting closer to the main road. You're now going to get people as they come in with their grain off of the main road. They're going to stop off. It's not grain yet. When they bring in what they're bringing in from the fields, they're going to come to you. They're going to mill it with you, and then they'll turn it into flour. That's the way it's going to work. It is grain.
It's like a land lease. It's some kind of almost a rationalization to have a legal right to that.
Yeah. Yes. So that's the Talmudic statement of Rav Huna. Now, there is some debate as to whether Rav Huna is correct. If you take a look at the next source number 4, you find the view articulated by the Mordechai. The Mordechai is a commentary, legal commentary, written in, I'm going to call him 13th century, roughly. He says, if a street is closed on three sides, okay, so now it's an alley that's actually enclosed all around. And only on one side is it open for entry, that side being the main road. So forget everything I said about yards and houses coming off of it. This is it. It's a dead end. And Reuven lived near the closed end. Okay, so if this is... Well, this can't be the alleyway. This is the alleyway. Okay, here's your main road. This is the alleyway. I hope you listening on here can hear that. Here's the alley. All right? Reuven lives here, near the closed end of the alley. And he sets up his shop over here. And Shimon came to live near the open end, closer to the road, such that a non-Jew could not enter the street without passing Shimon's entrance. He doesn't mean specifically a non-Jew, but the idea is some businessman who doesn't know Reuven or Shimon, who is he going to go to? He's going to go to the one he gets to first, right? The law is that Reuven, who lives here, can prevent this, like the view of Rav Huna. The Mordechai says, I only agree with Rav Huna where it's enclosed. Because then you're entirely dependent on business coming from there. There's nobody coming in from the other direction. So he says, that's when I'll agree with Rav Huna. Otherwise, he says, I wouldn't agree. So, Rabbi Moshe Isserles says, everybody is going to agree in a case like that. There is no dispute in a case like that, and that's what this is like. What you did to Rabbi Meir of Padua. Because, realistically, he has a very defined market to which he can sell this book. And by you undercutting him on price, you're guaranteeing, it's just like someone planting himself at the entrance to the alleyway, no one's going to him anymore. That's it. So that's number one, is that it's unfair competition. That's one precedent that he calls upon. Second, he says, it's very important to support Torah scholars. He says, this work is put out with the investment of Rabbi Meir of Padua. We have to enable him to survive. Take a look at source number 5. He brings precedent again from the Talmud. Rav Dimi of Neherda. Neherda is a city in Babylon. Rav Dimi of Neherda brought dried figs by boat. Right, that's his merchandise. He goes out and he earns a living as an importer. The exilarch, who is the head of the Jews living in Babylon at the time, said to Rava, another sage, go and see, check out this Rav Dimi. If he's a young scholar, set up the market for him. I want you to enable him to make a good living. He's a guy who's trying to work. Help him out. So the argument is, we should be supporting him as a Torah scholar. Maimonides himself provides the foundation for this idea. If you take a look at source number 6 on the flip side of the page, Maimonides was dealing with a problem. There's a passage in Pirkei Avot. Avot generally consists of moral instruction that the sages collected. Literally, Pirkei Avot translates closest to central lessons, not ethics of the fathers. That's not probably an accurate read. The word Av in Aramaic, and it is an Aramaic title, refers to something that is central, like Avot Malacha, the central categories of work on Shabbat. So Pirkei Avot are central lessons. In any case, the passage there that Maimonides is commenting on says that Torah scholars are not supposed to profit from their Torah. They're not supposed to say to people, I'm a Torah scholar, therefore you should be nice to me. So Maimonides says, however, there's a difference between that and what we just read about supporting Rav Dimi with the figs. He says, these are the rules Hashem, God, established for them, for the scholars, just as he established gifts for Kohanim, the priests, and tithes for the Levites, as the tradition conveys. Merchants also do this for each other at times as a way of showing honor. I'm an American, so I wrote honor without a U. I apologize. Even where neither participant has the title of a sage, let a Torah scholar be treated as well as an honored layman. He says, look, realistically, merchants do favors for each other all the time out of respect for each other. We also do favors for people who are of scholarship because we want to show respect to them. So Rabbi Moshe Israel just takes that and says, you have to support Rabbi Meir Katzenelenbogen because he's the scholar here, as opposed to supporting Justiniani with his edition. A third reason that Rabbi Isterlis provides, quite controversial, I think, at various times in our history, but nonetheless, is that it's important to support the family. The idea is, he is family. Take a look at source number 7 in Midrash. From the Sifra, which is an ancient Midrashic work, you're talking about this something that dates back 1st century and earlier as a work of Jewish law. How do we know that when you sell, whatever you're selling, it doesn't matter, you should sell only to your friend, and when you sell to your friend is what the Torah says? And how do we know that when you purchase, you should purchase only from your friend? Same verse that they're quoting, or you purchase from your friend. They're quoting from a verse that has nothing to do with this. The verse says, when you sell to your friend, when you purchase from your friend, don't engage in gouging. That's the law. The law is about gouging. But they say, why did the Torah specify friend here? It must be to teach me you're supposed to sell to your friend, buy from your friend. What does your friend mean? Your friend is meant to convey member of the family, also known as member of the tribe, also known as Jew. The idea is we need to make sure that we support our businesses. Everybody else in the world has reason to support theirs. We need to make sure that we support our own. That's his third argument. Whether you like that statement or not, I can't. That's not my point. My point is that's what he said. His fourth idea is, you have a work here that's done by Rabbi Meir of Padua. You have a work here that's done by, this fellow Justiniani. If you ask me, the more reliable work is the one that was done under the aegis of Rabbi Meir of Padua. It's going to be a more reliable text. And he says, for that reason, you should go with it. If you take a look at source number 8, passage from the Talmud, which Rabbi Moshe Israelis quotes, Rabbi Ami said, one may not keep an unchecked Sefer Torah, an unchecked Torah scroll, for 30 days. Torah scrolls have to be read constantly. It's a big challenge when you have a synagogue which has multiple Torah scrolls. You have to make sure to rotate them so that they all get read. It's also a good idea to rotate them for a completely separate reason, which is humidity. You don't want the humidity to build up in there. It's bad for the ink, and it's bad for the parchment itself, and ultimately, with fluctuations, you can get cracking. It's bad for it. But his point here is
you can't read once it's cracked.
If a letter cracks, then traditionally it's disqualified. Depends on how the crack is and all that. But you can disqualify the scroll that way for ritual use. So he says, one may not keep an unchecked Sefer Torah for 30 days. It is written, do not maintain corruption in your tent. That's the Talmudic line. So he says that should apply to this text that's written by Justiniani. Who knows if he knows what he's doing? For all you know, his edition is littered with mistakes. So that's another argument that he presents. And then he says, well, maybe you'll argue that Justiniani is going to complain to the Venetian Senate, these Jews are boycotting me and buying from theirs. So he says, don't worry about that. He quotes a work of Tosafot. Tosafot is actually a group work written by dozens of scholars in the 13th century. 13th into the 14th, and they said, in a separate context completely, in commerce, if you would choose to buy from a Jew specifically, what enmity exists? Could a Jew not say, I don't need to sell or buy anything now, meaning if Justiniani files a claim and says these Jews aren't buying off him, they'll say, well, we didn't need to buy anything off of you. We would have bought off of you, but we didn't need it. What are you going to do? That's his argument. And so he rules in favor of a mayor of Padua, not because of copyright, but for all these other reasons that he adduces from the Talmudic text. And he decrees that Jews should not buy the Justiniani edition. Well, Justiniani, in the end, is run out of business by Bragadin, much the way that Justiniani ran Bamberg out of business, proving once again that karma gets you. The House of Bragadin emerges to dominate Hebrew printing in Venice until well into the 18th century. But there are serious ramifications of this war. Bragadin went to press with an edition of the Talmud, somewhere around 1553, which is why I dated this to 1552. It's at some point in that range. Justiniani is bitter. And what he does is he hires Jews who have converted out to Christianity to go to Rome and convey to the officers there in the Vatican negative messages about the Talmud, about the Talmud contains this bad thing and that bad thing, which was old news. They have been burning the Talmud since the 13th century. The major burning in Paris in 1240 is one example. But he wants them to stir things up and to say, this fellow Bragadin, he's going to print the Talmud. You know what's in the Talmud? It says these horrible, awful things. And the goal, ultimately, is to keep Bragadin from printing his edition. Well, Bragadin, in turn, hires his own people to go to Rome and to talk about Justiniani's edition, which actually had beaten him to press. There's actually, I think I gave you there on the last source, Bragadin has a note that he puts into his printing regarding his printing of the Talmud. He says, this is a printing of the Tanakh, the scripture. He says, and I know that when the master of this slave, he's using humble terminology for himself, will see that I've begun to publish the 24 works of Tanakh, of the Hebrew Bible, and Rav Alphus, which is a commentary, the legal commentary I mentioned earlier, to the Talmud. He too will race to the battle to do this work, and not sooner as he did with me regarding Maimonides. Meaning he's going to wait until I've done it, and then he's going to take advantage of my work. With this, I will know that you will praise me, for it is due to me that books will be available cheaply. That's his sales pitch to the Jewish population. So there's this bitter competition. The result is the Pope declares a public burning of the Talmud. And a burning of the Talmud, even when you already have a printing press, is horrific. It's expensive. It's difficult. I mean, the Talmud is 5,400 pages. And that's an hour edition today. That's not talking about the edition that they had. It's a massive work. This results in tremendous destruction. Not only that, the Pope decrees a ban on the printing of Jewish books in Venice until 1564. Yes, the Pope could do that. It also prevents Bragadin from producing other works that he had been preparing. Here's an interesting side note, though. Because of the burning and because of the bans, the Jews need to turn to another work in order to have a legal work on which to rely. Maimonides' work is one, but that becomes difficult to access because of the bans. And they end up turning to a different work altogether. I mentioned that Maimonides' work in his Mishneh Torah ends up being the work from which law is studied for a few centuries. Maybe not a few centuries, maybe a couple of centuries, because there's a man named Rabbi Yaakov, we know him as Rabbi Yaakov Baal HaTurim, who comes out with a new work called the Tur. The Tur literally means the column. Arba Turim is the full name, four columns. And essentially what he did was he rewrote the structure of Jewish law into four much easier to use organizations of Jewish law, and that's known as the Tur. Along comes Rabbi Joseph Caro, who I mentioned earlier, and he writes a commentary on that called Beit Yosef, which is the foundation for ultimately his Shulchan Aruch, his code of Jewish law. Because of all the burning of the Talmud, though, and the prevention of the publication of the Rabbi Alphus work of law, and the problems with the publishing of the work of Maimonides, the result is that Italian Jewry turns to this other work, Beit Yosef, of Rabbi Joseph Caro, as their legal work. And they end up developing their customs and their practices around it. So that we have now seen, I didn't emphasize this earlier, but I'll mention it now, we've now seen two ways in which non-Jewish publishers ended up changing the course of Jewish study and practice. One, Daniel Bamberg decides who to put in his Mikraot Gedolot collection, edition of the Bible, and because he puts them in, everybody studies them for centuries afterwards. Who knows who he left out? That's number one. And number two, now, because of this battle between Bagadin and Justiniani and the Pope's actions, they end up changing, effectively, how they decide law. Italian Jewry changes its practices to follow, instead, the Beit Yosef. And the impact of this case continued all the way through the early 19th century. And the story of the Heidenheim Machzor. In brief, the Rabbi Wolf Heidenheim printed a Machzor. Machzor, the work of liturgy for Rosh Hashanah and for Yom Kippur. And it had his scholarship and his commentary and poetry and everything else. And there was a ban against printing it, other than printing his edition. You couldn't copy his edition. That was the idea. There was another city, though, in which they flouted the ban. And they decided they were going to reprint it anyway and make the money themselves. By the early 19th century, it's much easier to do, certainly, in terms of the technology than it was back in the 16th century. You're no longer setting the type. You know, it's you've advanced in that regard. So that gets litigated to the authority of Rabbi Moshe Sofer, also known as Chatam Sofer, who is in Pressburg in Hungary, and he argues that the ban has to be upheld, and even in the other city, and one of his reasons for it is, he quotes Rabbi Moshe Isserlis's ruling about unfair competition from this case here. So this becomes precedent for Jewish copyright law for centuries going forward. So, to summarize what we have, we started out by talking about the church-controlled printing that went on in the early days, the church becoming an early adopter of the printing press for its own use, and also wanting to prevent the printing of heresy. In Venice, the Senate, that third arm of the government after the Doge and after the major council, but really the executive arm, controls, in general, controls the trades, but it certainly controls printing. In 1469, they give their first monopoly to a printer. They gave out monopolies in Hebrew printing also, initially to Jews, but then Jews were banned from it and it went over to the Christian press. Bamberg first. Justiniani ran out Bamberg. And then Justiniani faces competition from Bragadin with Romero Duas. Justiniani comes out with his own edition, condemning the edition of Romero Padua and of Bragadin, and offering his edition at a lower price. The decision goes to Rabbi Moshe Isserlis in Krakow, who this young Torah scholar, who comes up with four reasons why the Jews should not buy the Justiniani edition until Romero Padua's edition sells out. One reason is unfair competition, a second to support Torah scholars, a third to support this Jewish business, and fourth to encourage people to buy works that have been properly checked. And that decision ultimately feeds into this rivalry between Justiniani and Bragadin that leads to the burning of the Talmud in Italy, leads to the prevention of publication of other works, leads to the primacy of Rabbi Joseph Caro's work of law in Italy, and ultimately is a precedent. The original decision is a precedent that's cited in law. Really, I mentioned 19th century, but the truth is it's still quoted down till today. Okay. Thank you very much.